Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The whole world's been watching these last few days as scientists report a huge stretch of ice shelf off the Antarctic is now looking very precariously attached. Physicist Helen Chersky is watching, too, Antarctica and much more, the way physics is always at work around us. This hour On Point, we check in on the Antarctic ice shelf and then on physics much closer to home. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. I want to go first to the splitting of a huge ice shelf in Antarctica. It's nearly the size of Delaware and ready to split off into the ocean, we're told, potentially any day now. Joining me first from New York is Andrea Thompson, senior science writer at Climate Central, a climate science research and news organization. Andrea, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we've been hearing about this just since late last week. The report came in from British scientists. What's going on this ice shelf?
So there's this rift that they've actually been watching for several years now. It's sort of been winding its way across the ice shelf and it just made a big leap forward in December. It had actually made a previous one over our summer, the Antarctic winter. So they keep seeing these kind of jogs forward of this rift, and now it's only hanging on by kind of a slender thread, about 20 kilometers of ice. So it could cause an iceberg to break off kind of any time now, although it's a little uncertain how quickly it might happen.
An iceberg sounds like something you'd see bobbing alongside, a freighter, but we're talking really something massive here.
Yes, this, you said the iceberg that could break off is about the size of Delaware. The whole ice shelf is much larger, but this would be the biggest iceberg to break off of Antarctica in quite a while. So it would definitely be a major, major event.
We're talking about Larsen C, it's called here. That's the whole ice shelf. Larsen A and B already fell off some years back. So is it a big deal if this one falls off too? I mean, we've all seen the images of, glaciers calving or shedding big chunks of ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a big deal if this breaks off. When these ice shelves, when you have these big calving events, it causes the glaciers that feed into these ice shelves to speed up, which means you have more ice coming from land going into the ocean, which causes sea level rise, which, has effects far beyond Antarctica. And they saw that with the collapse of Larsen A and B, the glaciers behind them definitely sped up after their collapses in 1995 and 2002.
Is Antarctica melting or just, shedding ice in a normal fashion here?
So there's iceberg calving is a natural part of the whole glacier ice shelf system. The problem is there is warm water kind of seeping in under these ice shelves and melting them from below and causing them to destabilize a bit. And then you also have warming air temperatures, which are causing some melting from above. And the combination of those two is putting a lot of pressure on these ice shelves. So you are seeing melt primarily around the coastline of Antarctica along these ice shelves, not as much in the interior. But it is a major cause of concern because Antarctica has a lot of ice that could add a lot of sea level rise if you were to see substantial destruction.
If it goes to that, Andrea Thompson, please stand by in New York for a moment. I want to bring in Daniel McGrath. He's a geophysicist and glaciologist at Colorado State University. He's traveled to Antarctica. He's stood on the Larsen C ice shelf several times in recent years. Joins us today from Fort Collins, Colorado. Daniel McGrath, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So, we're all watching from afar, and unlike you, we haven't stood on Larsen C. What did you make of the report that came out last week that the crack, if you will, or rift in the shelf has grown substantially, and some people saying it's at risk within, weeks, months of toppling off? Is that clear to you?
It's a very concerning recent growth of this rift. We've been watching it very closely since around 2014 when the rift started this period of rapid growth. And it's kind of been growing in these stops and jumps. And this is the third of these kind of major jumps it's made, where it's crossed a section of the ice shelf, you know, 10, 12 miles at a time, very rapidly. And so, you know, at this point, the rift is more than 50 miles long and is quite close to reaching the far side of the ice shelf, at which point a very large calving event would occur.
Okay, so you're a glaciologist. You've stood right there. Does this look to you like something that just happens in the natural order of things? Or the question that everybody, you know, has in the back of their mind, is this related to climate change, global warming?
You know, calving events, as Andrea mentioned, are a natural process. They help maintain the balance of the ice shelf. If an ice shelf didn't calve and lose icebergs, it would be getting progressively larger. And we know that's, you know, in a steady climate, that's not what's going to happen. So there's at present not a direct link to climate change for this rift in particular. But if we put this rift into the context of all the environmental change that's occurring on the peninsula, the dramatic warming that occurred during the latter half of the 20th century, the collapse of, as you guys have been discussing, Larsen A and Larsen B ice shelves, and then the acceleration of tidewater glaciers or glaciers whose snout is in the water all along the Antarctic Peninsula, you know, there's a lot of very dramatic change occurring in this region. And if this calving event were to occur, we would see Larsen C at its smallest extent that we've observed it. And that is very concerning. It's very concerning in the sense that we don't know how the ice shelf will respond in the future. Is it going to be more vulnerable to further calving events and potentially sometime in the future a complete collapse like we saw for these other ice shelves?
What would a complete collapse look like? What does that even mean?
You know, we have a few examples of this. Larsen B is kind of the best example. And in that case, in a matter of weeks, the entire ice shelf kind of splintered into many small icebergs. And there are a number of feedback processes at play that kind of just caused it to literally splinter into thousands of small icebergs. We don't expect that to occur for Larsen C at present. Larsen B had been modified or preconditioned to be susceptible to that style of collapse. We don't see that for Larsen C. And so, you know, we expect, you know, if this calving event were to occur, we're going to see an acceleration of the ice shelf because it no longer has this ice out in front of it resisting its flow.
Yep.
And we may see other rifts cutting into the ice shelf. This rift that we're watching very closely is one of about 10 other rifts. And these rifts have been present on the ice shelf since the earliest images in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But once this rift goes there's the potential that one of these rifts further upstream might start propagating into the ice shelf, and that would be very concerning.
Now, the ice shelves themselves, this ice shelf, it rests in the water, right? So even if it goes, it doesn't have a sea level effect immediately, and yet people talk about sea level concern here. Does that get back to, what did you call it, tidewater glaciers with their snout in the water?
Well, you're exactly right. That ice shelves, they're floating, and so if we were to calve this iceberg, we're not going to see a change in global sea level because of that. But as Andrea mentioned, these ice shelves act as a plug for the glaciers that are upstream of them that feed these ice shelves. And so if you remove the ice shelf, those glaciers will start flowing faster. And at that point, you'll be discharging more ice to the ocean, and you'll see a contribution to global sea level. Ice shelves ring the vast majority of the Antarctic ice sheet. So it's not just Larsen C and Larsen B on the peninsula. There's many other large ice shelves, the Ross ice shelf and the Bonny ice shelf. And these ice shelves, they hold back tremendous amounts of ice inland on the Antarctic ice sheet. And so we use Larsen C and the other ice shelves on the peninsula as kind of a case study to really learn about how ice shelves operate, what makes them stable, what makes them unstable. And we use that understanding to inform our assessment of these other ice shelves much further south on the continent.
When, you know, you talk about glaciers behind the ice shelves, then we're into the sort of heart of the Antarctic ice cap, if that's the right way of putting it, I guess?
Yeah, we like to refer to it as an ice sheet. But
ice sheet, okay. But, you know, the part that's not floating in the water but is sitting on Earth. In the dire scenarios about sea level rise, is there a concern that itself significantly shrinks, or does it not take a significant melting for that to change sea level?
We know from geologic evidence that 120,000 years ago, during the last interglacial, the last time that the planet was quite warm, sea levels were between 6 and 9 meters higher than they were today. And we know that a large part of that sea level rise came from our ice sheets. And when we really think about where that could come from, we point our finger to the Western Antarctic ice sheet. So this is kind of to the south of the Antarctic Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And there we're seeing tremendous change as well. There's a number of glaciers there, Thwaites and Pine Island. And these glaciers have been referred to as the weak underbelly of the Western Antarctic ice sheet. They sit on bedrock, but they sit on bedrock that slopes inward. So as you progress towards the interior of the ice sheet, the bedrock is deeper and deeper and deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an instability, in that if you start calving back and you start losing ice from those glaciers, which we're observing, it's a self-fulfilling feedback. It's going to keep going. It's an instability that has the potential to contribute very significantly to global sea level.
What portion of the ice sheet would you have to lose in the Antarctic to bring about very problematic sea level rise globally?
You know, it all depends on where you live. If you have a hotel that's 20 centimeters above current sea level, you're very concerned in the next few decades. But by the end of the century, we're looking at anywhere from 1 meter to upwards of 2 meters of global sea level. That's very concerning for millions of citizens all around the world.
But that kind of rise, does that mean the ice sheet going away, or just melting around the edges is enough to do that?
Just melting around the edges, if the entire ice sheet went away, we'd be looking at more than 70 meters of global rise. So this is just the fringe between Greenland, which has about 7 meters of global sea level rise stored in it, and then Antarctica. And so we're just losing the fringes of these ice sheets. And, you know, there's very significant change stored in these ice sheets.
The fringe of the Antarctic ice sheet, enough to change the world. Daniel McGrath is a geophysicist and glaciologist at Colorado State University. He has stood on Larsen C, where the big crack has opened up. Daniel McGrath in Fort Collins, Colorado, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom, thanks for having me.
And Andrea Thompson at Climate Central in New York. Andrea, thank you so much for coming on as well.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at this hour at the way the world works, the physics behind the big stuff, like the big crack in the Larsen C ice shelf in Antarctica, but also behind the little stuff going on around us all the time. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you riveted by the ice cracking off Antarctica? Do you understand what's going on there, what it could mean? Are you tuned in to the laws of physics governing the planet and our everyday lives? What's your question about how things work in physics terms? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Helen Chersky. She is a physicist at University College London. She also presents science documentaries for the BBC, writes a monthly column for BBC Focus magazine. She's out with a new book called Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Helen Chersky in London, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
There's a lot we want to look at with you, not all of it on such grand scale, but I think you've been listening in on the talk about what's going on in Antarctica these days with the ice shelf there, the big crack in it. As a physicist, what's going on in your mind as you, along with the rest of the world, watch that drama play out?
Well, it's interesting because the thing about that ice shelf is it really shows the power of a weakness, you know. Things break. Most materials are quite strong, but if you put a little crack in something, it becomes much, much weaker. And as that crack spreads through, it makes it harder and harder for that last little bit of ice that hasn't cracked to hold on. And we actually use weaknesses in our everyday world. You know, we tend to think of weaknesses as a bad thing, but when you have, you know, perforations in paper that you tear, for example, or when you break a bar of chocolate, you know, there's little Vs in a bar of chocolate, it always breaks at the V. And that's what's happening at the ice shelf. It's actually, you know, sometimes we manufacture weaknesses like that to help things break in the right place. And sometimes, you know, we're watching, just knowing this weakness is going to go at some point. Waiting for the end.
We want to get right down to the very intimate everyday elements of life. But I'm also curious how a physicist looks at the whole conversation around global climate change. The laws of physics are immutable, but the planet status quo is not. So how are you thinking about climate change when you hear about potential physical manifestations of it? As a physicist, does it look to you like, well, that's fine, the universe goes on, it's just a little water here or water there? Or do you have a different perspective entirely?
Well, my study is actually the study of the physics of the ocean surface and how the ocean breathes. So I do think about this quite a lot. And my attitude to this really is that I think each of us has three life support systems, a body, a planet and a civilization. And they're each keeping us alive in their own ways. And part of the problem with climate change is that two of those systems, the civilization and our planet, are kind of butting up against each other. You know, they've come into conflict. And that's the reason it's such a thorny issue. And so I do think that climate change matters, because this system really is keeping us alive. You know, like you say, the planet's going to go on either way. But the point is that our infrastructure depends on the planet working the way it does now, and the way that, you know, energy and nutrients and everything else in the environment is distributed around the planet. That depends on this planetary system working the way it does. So really, the problem with climate change is not so much for the planet. You know, we're undergoing a sixth major extinction, which have happened before in human history.
Meaning mass extinction of species.
Of species, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this one's happening now, and it's happening really quickly. And the problem is not for the planet. It's for our infrastructure not being able to adapt our systems in order to keep our life support systems running. So that's the bit that isn't talked about, I think, is that really, you know, any mass extinction is an extremely sad event. But if you're a pure pragmatist, this is also, you know, our systems depend on it, where our agriculture is, how we travel, how we move things around the world. All of that depends on the Earth system being as it is now. And if it changes very, very quickly, then we've got a problem. And sea level rise is actually a good example of that. So sea level is actually rising for two separate reasons. So there is the idea that more ice is coming off the land and getting into the oceans.
Yep.
So that takes up more space. But also the oceans are warming, and you can measure this. And things that are warmer tend to expand. And so about half of sea level rise is actually due to thermal expansion. So it's not just that there's more water in the oceans, it's that water is warmer and therefore it takes up more space. And things like that have a big impact on how our civilization operates, you know, especially if you're living near the sea. So it is all interlinked. There is a lot of physics in there, but fundamentally it's about how systems work and understanding what it is that's keeping us alive.
I guess I love your idea of three life support systems: our body, like individual bodies, the planet, and then civilization on top of that. For a long time, the civilization and planet operated independent of one another, or at least the civilization was marginal enough in its impact that it didn't make much difference to the planet, I suppose. In physics terms, what's happening there now? Are humans redirecting energy on a mass scale somehow?
Yeah, so the extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is changing the way energy is distributed, and it means that what we would call the equilibrium temperature, so the temperature at which things tend to settle, has got a bit higher. That's why the atmosphere is warming. It's letting a little bit less out, and so the planet warms up a little bit in response. Yeah, so our civilization has traditionally been very much sort of superficial, like a, you know, just sitting on top. But relatively recently, you know, in the 50s and 60s, it was thought that things like the oceans and the atmosphere were just too big. You know, how could a human ever, you know, these systems are so enormous. Mm-hmm. How could we possibly touch them? And yet, as we've found out, there are so many of us now, and we're so good at manipulating our environment, at mining things, at using things, at moving stuff around and throwing it away, that we are having a measurable effect both on our atmosphere and on our oceans. And so now really it's a question of stewardship. And really what you need to do is understand how the system works. There's kind of two problems. You've got to understand how the engine moves along, right? What it's doing normally. And then you want to understand how the engine is changing, because, you know, we still want to survive. It's a complicated problem, but these systems are fascinating, you know, all these interlinking kind of little cogs that work together. And it's a fascinating thing to study. It's the reason I study ocean physics, because it's complicated, which makes it, it's never easy. But it's fascinating because of all these links that come together to make this engine work.
Physicist Helen Chersky's new book is Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. It's ironic, and you've noted this, but that at the same time that at the civilizational level, we are apparently impacting the very system of the planet's operation. At a personal level, you know, people are sort of more and more detached from the physical world. We're dependent on it, but our sort of mental awareness of those interactions may be diminished. Why do you think that's so?
It's a sort of sad thing, isn't it, to feel that we're becoming more distant from our surroundings. But the wonderful thing of technology, you know, smartphones and touchscreens and all of that, does many amazing things for us. And as life becomes more complicated, we need things in the system to do stuff for us because we can't do everything for ourselves. And the problem is that the danger is that we then become helpless because we don't have to do things anymore. We just forget the reasons for doing them in the first place. And so one of my real bees in my bonnet is that I feel people don't play with the physical world as much. You know, if you go back even 30, 40 years, when something broke, you tried really hard to fix it because it was probably the only one you had. You know, you kind of valued materials and the expertise that gone into building something. And now it's so easy to buy something and throw it away. And there's no incentive to kind of get stuck into what it's doing. But we still live in a body that's about this big. You know, you and I are still sitting on chairs that are about this high. Mm-hmm. For all the smart technology in the world, we still got to deal with the physical world as well. And I think it's such a shame if we become helpless. And the first step in not being helpless is just having a bit of curiosity about what's going on around you and not being afraid. If you understand the kind of framework for how things work, you can explore and investigate and take responsibility for yourself rather than just being told, you know, by the manufacturer of something, oh, well, you need a new one now. You can actually do something yourself. So I think, and it's a ridiculous situation to be in because we've got more information available about how the world works than humans have ever had in the history of humanity. We've never known as much as we do now. But the problem is it's sort of somewhere else. It's in the internet somewhere. We can look it up, but we don't. And so we're becoming a bit physically helpless, and I want to stop that. That's why I wrote the book.
You're looking to reconnect us to the physics going on around us. Take us right to the title of your book, Storm in a Teacup, and the physics in a teacup. When we splash a little cream in there and give it a stir, you look at that and take it right out to a almost planetary scale as well. Draw the connection.
Well, I'm British, so I drink a lot of tea and I put milk in my tea.
All right.
Which is important to say because not everyone does. And when we Brits travel abroad, people give us funny looks for putting milk in tea. But when you stir, and you know, this is the same with coffee. If you stir a cup of coffee in and you add some cream to the coffee, mm-hmm. or you add some milk to the tea, mm-hmm. what you see is that the two liquids swirl around each other. They don't just kind of merge into one another. They form this eddy, this little sort of spiral, and then they mix like that. They mix by that spiral getting tighter and tighter and tighter until the two liquids have mixed together. And that's a sort of little observation, which is a pattern that you see in lots of other places. And the reason for calling the book Storm in a Teacup was that if you look up into the sky, especially at the sort of latitudes that we're at, you see these big rotating storms. And there's a similar process is happening. The warm air from the south and the cold air from the north don't just barrel straight into each other and kind of merge. What they do is spin around, and that's where you get these sort of anticyclones, these rotating storms that mm-hmm. move eastwards across America and come across to us here in Britain. And it's the same mixing process. So you see this thing that liquids do, and you see it in your teacup, and you also see the same thing in the atmosphere, and the same thing is driving Jupiter's big red spot, for example. So there's one, the idea is that the world is full of patterns, physical patterns. And once you've seen a pattern in one place, you see the same pattern again and again and again. So learning about physics isn't kind of learning a pile of facts. It's about learning a small number of principles, these patterns, and then you see them again and again and again. So it basically, I mean, you know, you could call it science for lazy people because it's not about learning an infinite supply of facts. But a small number of principles get you a long, long way in understanding your world.
Take us to the principles then that govern that milk in the tea as it's swirling after my first stir, or that storm in the sky, for that matter, Jupiter in its red spot. What's the principle at work there?
Well, the principle is that it takes a long, long time for two liquids to kind of go into each other. If you imagine taking two combs, for example, you know, with the sort of the sticky out bits facing each other and pushing them into each other, that doesn't happen. That the principle is that that's not how mixing happens. Mixing happens because things have to move around each other. It's much easier to go round in circles than it is to just go straight into something. So that's why we stir tea or coffee. That's why we have spoons, is that stirring makes a spiral pattern, which makes it easy for things to mix. And it's the same in a bioreactor, for example. If you're growing cells in a lab, for example, you have a stirrer that makes things go round and round because that's an efficient way to mix things. And in your mixer, you know, like a kitchen mixer, you make things go round and round. You create the shearing process because that's where mixing happens. So it's just, you see it all the time. One of the things about this is that people have actually, I think, got quite a lot of knowledge. It's just that they haven't got anywhere to put it. You know, they haven't connected together that quite a lot of these patterns are the same thing. And so that's what the book's about. It shows that the places where a pattern can happen, you know, the idea that the physics that happens when a towel kind of soaks up some spilled water is the same as the physics that limits the height of a tree. And it's the same as the physics that makes insulin tests work, those little insulin testing strips. And so once you've seen the pattern, it comes up again and again and again. And you can learn to spot it. And that's the fun bit. It's not all about pragmatism. It's fun to look out the world and look at these things and recognize and then go, oh, I know why that is. I've seen that before.
Principles
and that's
work.
Something that we've forgotten to enjoy.
Milk in the tea or storm in the sky. Helen Chersky writes about it in Storm in a Teacup. It's her book. Will is calling from Cornish, Maine. Will, you're on the air with Helen Chersky in London.
Hi, Tom. Hi. And hi, Helen. So much appreciated what's on your heart about our environment and the different aspects that you look at and are so fascinated with. I'm looking forward to your book. My question for you in your experience is that in looking at the world as a whole, if you would put it on a grid and you look at that, and if you see all the impacts that our ever-increasing population is putting on it in the form of infrastructure impacts, so a couple major ones would be fracking, would be draining our water reservoirs of all the water and removing it from those subterranean reservoirs onto surface use, and oil. That this whole idea of the power of weakness, is there a possibility of a culminating effect?
A culminating effect. That sounds very apocalyptic, Will. But you mean frack enough and drain the aquifers enough, and what we're gonna crater here somehow?
Well, it's this idea of part of the picture, Tom, would be this idea of a diamond, and you have a rough stone, but a master jeweler will look at it and study it, and then go, ah, if we hit this here, this will all come apart and the jewel will be revealed inside.
Let us pick it up, Will, and I appreciate your call. Helen, I too was struck by your notion of the power, ultimately, of a weakness to be the point at which change comes. You hear Will looking at any number of physical interventions that civilization is making and asking, I don't know if it's about an apocalypse, but about a culminating event. What are you thinking when you hear that question?
Well, there is this concept of tipping points, which is one of the ways of referring to this. And the idea of a tipping point is that it's to do with feedback. So that if you change something in the world, quite often when you change something, you change it a little bit, and that changes something else a little bit, and you change the first thing a bit more, and the second thing, and so it kind of goes along bit by bit by bit. And the idea of a tipping point is it's a bit more like falling off a cliff. You know, you take a step forward, and you move a little bit, you take a step forward, and then you take another step forward, and you fall off the cliff. And the idea is that there's some big change. There's the potential for some big changes where every step is not the same as every other step, and some will have a much bigger effect. And There are examples of this in the Earth system. For example, Arctic amplification, which is a way of expressing that temperatures in the Arctic are increasing much more than on the rest of the planet. And it's partly because the changes that are happening in the Arctic make more warming happen, and then that makes it warmer, and then those changes happen more quickly. So the concept of tipping points is, it's hard to tell. You don't know till you've got one. That's the problem with them. So we all want to understand the system better so that if they do exist, we can see them coming. But yes, tipping points, if they're serious, could be a big problem for us.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the way the world works, its physics, from the Antarctic to, what, the palm of your hand, or right there, the sound of a thunderstorm, as soothing as it is in a way. That is the sound of titanic exchanges of energy in the form of water, electricity, heat. Helen Chersky is with us, physicist, joins us today from London. She's at the University College London. Her new book is Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. She's looking to remind us of all the principles being played out right around us all the time. You can join us this hour. What's your question about how things work in physics terms? Why about popcorn explodes or cream swirls in your coffee? Why ducks' feet don't get cold, freeze on the ice, or ketchup is so stubborn about exiting the bottle? You name it, she's got the answers. For that matter, about how we might want to stay a little more tuned into the physics of what's happening around us, not get too removed or blasé. Helen Chersky joins us from London. And Helen, we've got callers for you. Annie in Charlotte, North Carolina. Annie, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Helen in London.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Helen. I teach high school equivalency, so GED science, to adults who are returning to school to complete their high school credential. And I loved what you said about that we actually have these experiences and knowledge but haven't had a place to put it or the pattern to fit it into, because that really reflects my experience with my students.
So give us the experience, or recognize the experience, because very often all this is happening right around us.
Mm-hmm.
And Annie, I appreciate your call. I mean, Helen, you make it just as plain as can be. Here's the sound of a popcorn popping in the kitchen. You take that very ordinary everyday experience and relate it to a whole lot of mechanical action going on around us at the same time. Give us the principle right there with the popcorn. Take it out into our world, Helen.
If you can explain popcorn, you can also explain the internal combustion engine and hot air balloons and quite a lot of catabatic winds up Antarctica and cake, all very important things.
Oh, yeah.
And the principle behind popcorn is that inside the popcorn kernel, so the reason popcorn's unusual is because the kind of outer shell, the husk, mm-hmm. is waterproof. And it's very hard for anything to get through it. So inside the corn, there's a bit of space, and there's lots of water. And when you heat it up, that water becomes a gas. And the problem is it's kind of trapped inside this kernel. And those water molecules, when they become a gas, they're molecules that are just kind of floating around playing bumper cars inside the kernel. And as you heat it up and heat it up, they get faster and faster and faster and faster, because that's what heat is. It's more and more and more movement in the molecules. And so that all builds up. And so while all of that's going on, all the starch on the inside of the kernel, that's getting cooked into some kind of gloop-like stuff. And eventually, the pressure gets higher and higher and higher on the inside, and it bursts the kernel. And that's when you get that pop. And then all the white gloop on the inside, mm-hmm. That's full of this hot gas, expands outwards and explodes, forms a little popcorn shape and then sort of re-solidifies. So the cooking is done inside the kernel and then it reshapes itself at the moment it pops out and cools down. So the idea behind that is that if you heat up a gas, especially if you confine it when you heat it up, the pressure goes up and up and up and up because you've got all these molecules that are hitting the walls faster and faster and faster. And that can actually do something useful. And so the same idea explains how the internal combustion engine works. So in your car, you know, you've got cylinders. And in that case, it's a fuel explosion, fuel and oxygen burn together. And you get lots and lots of gas molecules that are very, very hot, which means they're moving very, very quickly. And it's all those individual collisions of the molecules on the piston that pushes it, and that's what's powering your car forward. It's the push of all those molecules. So there's this way of thinking about a gas, which is that you can explain everything about what a gas does by considering how fast the molecules are moving, all playing bumper cars with each other, and how hard they push on the surroundings. And the same thing also leads you to rockets, for example. So there's a guy that I wrote about who back in the 1930s, was desperate to invent mail sent by rocket. He thought this was the great new modern thing. There was going to be mail by rocket. And he got funded to try this out by the people who collect stamps because they wanted a new kind of novelty stamp. So they said, oh, well, we'll pay for your rocket. So he did all these experiments that were based on this principle. Inside this little rocket, there was fuel that burned in the air. It made a lot of hot gas very quickly. And all those molecular collisions pushed forward on the rocket. So that pushes the rocket forward. And his idea was that this would take post somewhere to an island, perhaps. He was quite keen on islands because, you know, hard to cross.
Talk about air mail. Incoming
failed.
Rocket full of mail.
Idea.
All right.
Well, the first two exploded, and some of the letters still exist because they're kind of singed around the edges. they've got stamped on the top. It says Western Mail Rocket Post, I think. But he wasn't afraid to try it. The nice thing about that is he took the principle and he tried to apply it, and it didn't quite work. But, you know, if it had been a different time or a different place, that might have been the future of mail. And I really like that story because he wasn't afraid to try. You know, that's one of the things where you've got to try new things in life. And it wasn't his fault it didn't work, but, you know, he gave it a go. That's how progress is made, by people trying stuff.
Now we've got Amazon and others looking at drones for delivery, not rockets. A little different physics going on there. Missoula, Montana. Bob in Montana, you're on the air with Helen Chersky in London. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Helen, it's interesting. I teach folks how to fly airplanes, and so there's a lot of remedial physics that I need to inculcate. And I find that, these examples that you're using, Helen, are awesome. My fear is this. My fear is that science is a little like poetry. If you don't carry the principles around in your head, like carrying a poem around in your head by memorizing it, you have the tendency to not really apply it correctly. And I fear that sometimes this devolves into sort of a cutesy, detached awareness of things rather than a real understanding. My own experience with this happened when I was studying radiation for the first time. I was like, wow, this is really neat. And I got so detached from it that I forgot that it really had real consequences. And so my fear is that, yeah, we can talk about, the atmosphere being a closed system, much like a tea kettle, whereas if you add heat to it, it becomes unstable.
Mm-hmm.
But if people aren't making the right connections with that in the real world, the relevance of that science is diminished, and it just becomes sort of a cocktail party event.
How do you get to the real connection, Bob? Are you saying always have the math in there right alongside the narrative, the story, or where's the weakness?
Yeah, I think the math, and also, but what Helen said about the connecting the dots and making the connections, and always be looking for those consequences and the consequences of the consequences, and to walk around with that kind of curiosity and that kind of awareness. That's what we really need.
Bob, I appreciate your call. Stick with us for a second here. Helen, I mean, it sounds to me like you're looking at consequences. You take popcorn and turn it into internal combustion, and you could almost get right from there to climate change if you really wanted to stretch it. But consequences.
Well, of course, critical thinking is really important. And the hope is that by showing people where these things are in the everyday world, it encourages people to start thinking critically for themselves, you know, saying, oh, well, I think this is how it works. The next stage on from having an idea about how you think something works is to try it out and see if you're right, to come up with an experiment effectively that says, well, is this how it works? And there is this thing that, you know, there is this idea that a little bit of knowledge is dangerous because it gives you a lot of confidence, but you don't know about all the other knowledge that you haven't got. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't start on the journey. So it is absolutely true that a lot of things in the world are quite complicated and you have to understand more than one principle to get to the bottom of them. But the habit of critical thinking is really important, and not being afraid to ask questions. It's the habit of asking questions which is the important bit. And then, you know, obviously it would be great if people went further and further along that journey. But the first stage is feeling confident about asking questions and feeling confident about looking at the world and saying, can I answer this question? Can I do an experiment? Can I try something out to see if that works? So it's not that I recommend that everyone should, you know, have a look at their popcorn and then go out and try and build a rocket. But I do think that the principle is the same, and you have to start somewhere. And if you start by understanding the basic principles and learning how to think critically, it gives you, as much as anything else, it's about enabling you to ask the right questions. Because the world is full of things where if you ask the right question, you'll get the answer you need. And we're sort of losing the habit of asking questions. And I think this framework of understanding how the world works, more than anything else, gives you the framework for asking the right questions. So when someone's trying to sell you something, I don't know, a fridge or double glazing or something, you can ask the question that says, you know, well, what about the energy efficiency? What about what it does when you leave the door open? Whatever it is. So I think you do always have to be aware of what you don't know, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't start on the journey of improving what you do know.
Bob in Missoula, Montana, really appreciate your call. Take us somewhere completely different. You pay a little attention to whales here as another illustration of some physics principles, sperm whales in particular, and the kind of pressure that they deal with. Give us the story, Helen.
Well, imagine you're out a whale out in the open ocean, and sperm whales are famous for diving very, very deep. So one of the things that they like eating are giant squid. And in fact, the reason that the first sightings of giant squid were from bits that had been vomited up by sperm whales. So sperm whales go down very deep. Now, sperm whales are mammals. So like us, they have lungs. And there's a problem there, because if you go down deep in the, imagine this whale kind of out in the open ocean, it swims down towards the bottom of the ocean to go hunting, and its lungs are squishy, effectively. Most of the rest of us isn't very squishy, but the gas in your lungs can compress very easily. And so as you swim down, there's all this extra pressure of the water pushing in on your lungs. And that causes problems before you go very deep. And a sperm whale can hunt, I think, you know, typically around 500 metres, but they have been recorded down at 2 kilometres depth. So, you know, a few miles, basically.
Chasing those giant squid down there.
Chasing
whatever
giant squid. So what do you, you know, your lungs are going to be squished out of existence. And there's a problem that goes with that, which is that high pressure gas in your lungs, if it's got oxygen in it, can actually become poisonous. So the whales have this problem, which is that the gas in their lungs can't resist all this pressure. So what they do is exceptionally clever. When they're up at the surface and they're breathing, you know, they're hanging about at the surface, they're not actually just taking air into their lungs, they're taking oxygen into their muscles. And when they dive, they actually shut off their lungs. So it's not like, you know, when we swim down, we take a deep breath. That's not what the whale is doing. The whale has already filled up its muscles with oxygen. And then when it goes down below the surface, it kind of shuts off its lungs from the rest of its system.
So its lungs can collapse almost.
So its lungs can collapse, and that doesn't cause the whale any problems. And it's effectively breathing off the oxygen stored in its muscles.
What's the physics principle at work there, Helen?
Well, the principle is that the whale cannot keep its lungs inflated because in order for its lungs to stay the same size, they would have to hammer against the walls of the lungs. The gas on the inside would have to hammer outside as hard as the water was pushing inwards. And so it's a battle. And it's a battle that the whale's lungs can't win because mm-hmm. unless it was to heat itself up, like the popcorn, which mm-hmm. would be, you know, unpleasant and quite hard, yes. It can't, or somehow get some extra gas from somewhere, it can't, physically can't push hard enough. So it has to kind of lose that battle and find another way of getting the same thing done. So the principle is this battle between the gas molecules that always, where you've got one gas, like a balloon, for example, you've got gas on one side and gas on the other, the molecules are hammering against the surface and that's where the pressure comes from. And there's a limit to the amount of pressure you can get, you can cause from that hammering because the molecules can only move so quickly.
So draw the oxygen from the muscle instead of the lung and you've got a workaround there.
Yeah, that's why whale meat, which I hope really no one's ever seen, unless they've seen native whale hunts. But it's very deep, rich red. It's because it can store a huge amount of oxygen. And that's the reason it's such distinctive deep color.
I have actually spent years reporting from Japan and been out on those whaling ships and seen exactly that color. It is remarkable. People may not want to see it, but there it is. Take us from very large to very small. There's a wonderful passage here on bees and how bees know when another bee's been into a flower or not, been into a particular harvest.
Well, it's interesting this because electricity and magnetism is something which we've done so well at disguising it in our own world that we've kind of forgotten it's there a lot of the time. You know, the whole medium of radio works via electricity and magnetism, and yet we can't see it. But the bees are in there with electricity. It turns out that as bees, you know, bees fly by flapping their wings extremely quickly. A bee is not an aerodynamic thing. It's basically a sort of round lump with these little wings. Mm-hmm. But it can flap them fast enough to keep itself up in the air. And what's happening is that as the wings are beating, they're knocking electrons off the air molecules. And so the bee is acquiring an electric charge, just like if you kind of rub a balloon against your jumper, the balloon will acquire a static charge. The bee is doing the same thing. And what that means is that as it's flying around, coming up close to a flower, sometimes if you look in the right way, you can see as the bee gets close, pollen jumps from the flower onto the bee in response to the bee's electric charge. And that's kind of accidental. Normally the bee is going to land on the flower so it can collect the pollen for itself and it'll stick to its fur. But it does seem as though bees use this trick, which says that once they've landed on a flower, they lose their electric charge, so they go back to being neutral. And the flower, which had a very small electric charge, has also lost its charge. So the flower is neutral and the bee is neutral. So what that means is that if another bee comes along to a flower that's already had the pollen taken from it, it can detect that the flower doesn't have this tiny, tiny electric charge. And it seems that bees are more likely to avoid flowers that don't have an electric charge because it probably means another bee has been there recently. So they're better off going to another flower. So that was quite recent research. But it's, you know, it's interesting from the point of view that, you know, nature is will use whatever tools are available. And if you get these tiny electric charges in nature and the bee can notice them, then it might as well use them to survive. And so it does seem that some bees do this.
We've just got half a minute here. Do you think that if people pick up these stories and think about the physics behind them, they begin to reconnect with what's going on, the principles that work around them in this world, Helen?
Yes, because the moment of realization that you can work it out for yourself is really rewarding. And even adults get so happy about it. And so I think this habit of asking questions is absolutely for everyone.
Well, we've taken our listeners from massive ice shelf off Antarctica to the tiny buzzing of bee wings in this hour. And you've helped us do it. And we're very grateful for that. Helen Czerski is a physicist at the University College London. Her new book is Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Helen Czerski in London, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. It's been great.
Wonderful to have you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.